Thank you very much. Assalamualaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh. Salam sejahtera. Thank you very much for the opportunity. It is my honor to be speaking here in front of the distinguished professors and participants. So I'm the second speaker from Indonesia today, and some of the point that I would like to deliver today might be overlapped with the previous speaker, my colleague Dr. Boy Pradana, and so I might skip some of the slide. But the title that I'm speaking today is different from the title that is written in the module, Religion, Violence, and Peace Building. Religion, Violence, and Peace Building is actually my area of study. I teach religion, sociology of religions, and conflict transformation. That's how I'm my degree from. So Muslim supremacisms and the challenge to inclusive citizenship in Indonesia. By the term supremacisms, I do not mean that this is something that is related to our belief that in Adina, in the loyal Islam, that we believe that our religion Islam is the best religions, the most correct religions. But supremacism has been something, a phenomena, a political phenomena that we can find not only in Muslim community, but also in different contexts, including those with non-Muslim majority countries. So, and this is for me the challenge to inclusive citizenship, liberty, and prosperity that we are facing now in Indonesia. Next slide, please. Next slide, please. So let me, before I start my point about the situation in Indonesia, let us revisit our presumptions about religious freedom and prosperity. So I want to quote the finding of the research center, of the Pew Research Center here, some of the presumptions, which I'm not sure how many of us believe in this. The innovation strength is more than twice as likely among countries with low religious restriction and hostilities. Presumed effect of freedom of religion and belief on prosperity. This is the finding of, a survey in many countries which found that when you have more freedom of religion and belief, you have a country which reduce corruptions, more spaces, less harmful regulations, reduce liabilities, more diversities and growth. Some people might disagree with this because some people might think that the more freedom you have, the more instability you have, and the more instability you have, then it is less difficult to develop the country. But I found some of the presumption that we have here is relevant to the case of the experience of Indonesia, because the situations of religious freedoms in Indonesia, in my view, affects the ability of the government, to improve the economic, the prosperity condition of the country because of the burdens that, the government have to deal with the issue of religious freedoms in Indonesia. Next slide, please. So, in the first day, we talk about the experience of some countries, and especially I would like to, recall our sister from Tunisia who talked about the political transition in Tunisia that led toward the, the decline of democracy and the increasing power of the state. And in Indonesia, I found something which is quite the opposite, even though it's not totally contradictory, but after 32 years Indonesia under the authoritarian government of Suharto, in 1998 Indonesia embarked into a more open democracy. I mean, Suharto is democracy, but it's a different kind of democracy. After the fall of Suharto, the situation is completely changed because you have more space for the civil society. So over 50 years of relative political instability, bloodless peaceful political transitions, with recent trend of growing economy, There is an economic indicator of Indonesia suggests that our growth is above 5%. But the GDP also is rising and control inflation. This is happening especially under this two term of President Joko Widodo, which is ending his term next year, and he is now looking for successor because he cannot run for the third time in the election. So, you know, he has some big projects in the in Indonesia now, and he's looking for the best candidate that will continue his development projects in Indonesia. Even though Joko Widodo has been accused by some Muslim group as anti-Islamic. However, it is also Indonesia also see flourishing civil and uncivil society that save from, I want to borrow the term used by Jules Migdal in his book, yeah, strong state, weak society, to weak state, strong society. And this is, to some degree, what is happening in Indonesia, you know, with regard to, you know, the flourishing civil society in Indonesia. Indonesia is known for its civil society, but we have now more freedom and different kind of civil society are very active in Indonesia. Decentralizations lead to the rise of local political elites, many of which often exploited religious divisions and sectarian issues for electoral mobilizations. In some cases, local government consolidated power by allying with supremacist groups. The last few elections witnessed polarizing political climate and the relevance of Muslim supremacist rhetorics, especially during the Jakarta governor elections 2017 and 2019 presidential election in Indonesia. Supremacist Islamist politics has been, you know, influential in the process of the democracy in Indonesia. Next slide, please. And I would like to share one of the examples of what I mean by supremacist politics. This is, you know, an interview that I held with one of the one of the leader of Majlis Mujahidin Indonesia, a prominent Islamist group in Indonesia associated often with Jemaah Islamiyah. And I did this interview about maybe like 15 years ago for my master thesis, and I always remember this quote, yeah. When I asked about why did some Muslim commit terrorism and violence, and he quote this verse, and I believe some of you memorized this verse from Al-Hajj 39-40. Permissions to fight or qital has been given to those who are being fought because they were wrong. And indeed Allah is competent to give them victory. They are those who have been evicted from their home or driven out from their home only because they say La ilaha illallah, our Lord is God. So he referred to this verse to justify violence, to justify extremism in Indonesia, including those committing suicide bombing in Indonesia. Because in his interpretation, that the land of Allah, the land of Indonesia belong to Allah. Its majority populations are Muslim. It should be governed by the law of Allah. When the government did not allow the laws of Allah to rule, it is as they evict Muslim from their land. They driven Muslim out of their home because they do not allow Muslim to implement Sharia. So that's the conditions to, you know, the conditions for violence, because you believe that you are being driven out from your home because it is your home and you're not allowed to rule your home according to your law. So this is the rhetoric, even though I heard this rhetoric about 15 years ago, but this is repeated in many times, in which I believe is, you know, resonating to many audience of Muslim. So some of the key narrative which I think is now, you know, many Indonesians are dealing with, and maybe not only in Indonesia, of the supremacisms in Indonesia, that the belief that Muslims have been criminalized and treated unjustly. The ulama is, brought to jail, etc. So Muslim right to implement Sharia is guaranteed by Article 20, even though this is the Constitution, is guaranteed by Article 29 of the Constitution, as majority of Muslims should have special right in Indonesia. So the key of supremacism is the, you know, there should be differentiated citizenship for the majority. Yeah, Sharia law protect minority, reduce crime, and promote prosperity. Non-Muslim majority area might also make regulation based on their religious law. As we know that not all Muslim in Indonesia live as majority, but they demanded that because Indonesia is Muslim majority, so there should be some kind of privilege for the Muslim population in Indonesia over the other non-religious, non-Muslim populations. So Muslim exclusive citizenship for its unique role in independent. So they always claim that Indonesia got independent from the Dutch and it is Muslim who fought for the independent. And that's because of that, the privilege should be given to the Muslim. And this is the narrative, the supremacist narrative that justify, you know, hate and persecutions, discriminations against minority groups in Indonesia. Even though for some this is normal, yeah, we live as majority, this kind of majoritarianism is normal, but from those who live as minority group, this is a serious issue. And I would like to share, this is the picture that you can see on the slide, is the picture of the series of documentary film that we make. You can check in the website, the title of the series is indonesianpluralities.org. So we have about six to seven documentary films on Islam in Indonesia, which we can be useful for your educational purposes. So let me also mention some of the prominent supremacist leaders in Indonesia, which even though some of them are very vocal, some of them are very quiet, but you know, for me who is observing this movement for some period, even though sometimes they are quite active, sometimes they are quiet, but this has been a key force in mobilizing supremacisms in Indonesia. The first is Hizbut Tahrir Indonesia. We know Hizbut Tahrir is an international political movement in Indonesia, in Malaysia, in Bangladesh, in all Muslim majority country, even though they are not very big, yeah, but it is disbanded by the Indonesian government in 2017, but their leader are still free, so they are still very active in social media. The other is Bakhtiar Nasir, and the third is Rizik Syihab. Bakhtiar Nasir was the one who is leading the force for mobilizing the 212 movement that promote that Indonesia should not allow a non-Muslim to sit in the president in the government positions. So the government position should be an exclusive right of Muslim in Indonesia. So kafir should not be given a position in the government in Indonesia. So, and this is the rhetoric that has been there, and this is the challenge for inclusive citizenship in Indonesia. The same, I think Rizik Sihab is more famous, and he is, sometimes he is more pragmatic, but he is still a very, very influential figures among Muslims in Indonesia. And the last is a more mainstream Muslim preacher by the name of Abdul Somad. Even though he is mainstream, but he has been building this close alliance with the more supremacist Muslim organizations in Indonesia. So just for a background, I mean, this is how I draw the map of Muslim religious landscape in Indonesia. You see the two biggest circles are Nahdlatul Ulama and Muhammadiyah, the two moderate Muslim civil society in Indonesia. You can see from the spectrum of the most violent and the least violent, the most committed to the system and the less committed to the political system. You can see here, and you can see some smaller Islamist group who are more violence or less violent or more committed to less committed to the political system in Indonesia, like democracy. Even though they often support candidates in elections, but they don't really believe in democracy. For them, democracy is un-Islamic, so they're really looking for a way to overthrow democracy. In elections, this Islamist group has not been successful. But because they are not successful in election, they look for a different way to translate their movement. So one of the way they do is by most importantly by mobilizing at the level of the society by street politics, publishing in media, dakwah and educations, as well as this is very what is very important is vigilantism against minority in Indonesia. So it's not only because they hate minority groups, but they use negative sentiments against minority groups to mobilize in society. And that's why we see now, for example, some of the cases that are repeating in Indonesia. For example, the Shiite has been, in some places, has been persecuted in Indonesia. Some of them live in shelter for over 10 years without the ability to return to their original village. The number of recurring trends of violence and discriminations against minority groups in Indonesia, and this is because of the ability of the supremacist group to build some kind of alliance with the local political elites and use that for some kind of political gain in their failure for translating their voices at the national political level. Thank you very much.